This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, and we're joined by the legendary writer John Barry. Calls the French Quarter home for much of the year. He is, of course, a man of letters who has been recognized for his work about various topics, most notably about the flood of 1927, which ravaged Louisiana, Rising Tide, considered one of the best books of the 20th century. And in the 21st century, he started with a bang, and little did we know the book would have so much relevance today, The Great Influenza, about the 1918 pandemic. And we talked with him twice last year about comparisons between 1918 and COVID-19, and there are some comparisons, and of course there are some distinctions, and now we have a year to absorb what has happened and what may still occur, and we're not over this yet, but John Barry is on the front lines, and he is writing a new book about what is transpiring in our world today. And good morning to you, Coach Barry.
Good morning, Jim. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
You talked with Anthony Fauci last week. How did that go?
Well, I've known him for a long time. I don't pretend that we're close buddies, but in the course of researching the book, of course, I talked to him and others. So we have some mutual friends that both of us are, very close friends. In fact, a guy named Stuart Simonson, who's the Assistant Director General of the World Health Organization, and was actually an Assistant Secretary of HHS during Katrina, and was responsible for HHS's Katrina response. He's about the only federal government official who came out of Katrina with praise from Louisiana people who dealt with him.
Well, Fauci has become a controversial figure, as we know. He's 80 years old. He's been around a long time and has broad shoulders and seems to be handling the criticism. And he gets a lot of praise, too. And he's a ubiquitous presence on these national programs. Did he provide you any new information that you shook your head and said, I didn't know that?
Well, some. But one of the deals when you're writing a book is you promise people that you're not going to report anything that they say until the book comes out, which in my case is going to be 2024. If I'm lucky, it may be later than that. So a delicate question.
2024. Why so long?
Well, for me, that's short. The influenza book took 7 years. Rising Tide took 4.5. The book on Roger Williams took 8 years. So 2024 is for me speed writing almost. I wanted to write. There are a lot of books out on COVID already, and some of them I think are quite good. Scott Gottlieb's book, the book by the two Washington Post reporters, Nightmare Scenario, Michael Lewis's book. What I hope to do that's different a little bit is have the opportunity to have some perspective, wait for things to play out a little bit more. And obviously what's going on this year with Delta is not part of any of those other books. They've already been published. And I'll also probably have more of a global perspective.
John Barry is with us. He calls New Orleans home most of the year, also spends some time in Washington. His writing has received not only formal awards, but he has been recognized by places like GQ, named Rising Tide one of 9 pieces of writing essential to understanding America. That list included Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail and Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. So John Barry is celebrated for his work, and I'm sure he will have nuggets of information nobody else has when his book comes out in a few years. But right now, we don't know where this is going. It appears to be abating, but John, are we out of the woods?
Well, nobody can say that one way or the other. The virus remains in charge. I know that what prompted this invitation to appear was an op-ed that I wrote in the Washington Post last week about several scenarios where I think this could go. Some of them are pretty good. Some of them are not so good. It's impossible to predict. For one thing, within maybe a few weeks even, but certainly by Christmas, almost the entire population, at least 90%, is going to either be vaccinated or will have been infected and will therefore have some natural immunity. So what happens when almost the entire population has some immunity to the virus? There are several possibilities. Number one, Delta has so far outcompeted every other variant because it has this massive viral load. So the other variants haven't had an opportunity, haven't been able to gain a foothold in people because Delta has already been there. So the question is, again, what happens now? One possibility is that all you are going to see are breakthrough infections. And if that happens, that's a pretty good scenario because there are very few instances of severe cases, much less death, from people who have breakthrough infections. It does happen. But in terms of numbers, there just aren't that many. The overwhelming majority of people going to the hospital now and dying are unvaccinated. So that would be great if that's what happens, and it could happen. I think it's more likely, however, that another variant will emerge that can escape the immune protection that exists, evade it, not escape it entirely. And then you'll get another wave and another wave after that. The question remains, how serious will those waves be? I'm pretty optimistic that you will still get pretty significant protection from either vaccination or prior infection, and probably not that many deaths. That would be a pretty good situation, not quite as good as the first one, but still pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then you have a worst case and a best case. The worst case would be you get a variant that combines the incredibly large viral load produced by Delta and also has the ability to escape immune protection. That would not be good. And then all bets are off. And then the best case, the really best case, would be one of the things about Delta that's interesting is this enormous viral load in the upper respiratory tract, the nose, the mouth, and so forth. But there's not an indication that you're getting a comparably increased viral load in the lung. If that were the case, then you would probably be seeing a lot more deaths than we are seeing. Delta is more virulent, more dangerous than the earlier versions of the virus. We know that now. But it hasn't been this enormous uptick in deaths. It's been an uptick, but not in, three, four, five, eight times the death toll. So that sort of suggests that the virus is developing a tropism toward the upper respiratory tract. That would be great if that happens. And it could mean that it would eventually lose the ability to infect the lung and other parts of the body. And, this may have happened once before. There's a theory, which I'm obviously talking about it, but I'm not convinced by it, that the 1889 pandemic, which was known as Russian flu, was actually caused by a coronavirus.
Well, John Berry, the comparisons between 1918 and today have been talked about. We now have new information. Are there still some major similarities in addition to the distinctions between what happened then and what we're experiencing today?
Well, yeah, let me finish that last thought because it's important. The theory that the 1889 pandemic was actually caused by a coronavirus, that coronavirus would be one called OC43, and today it causes the common cold. If that's correct, and if this coronavirus goes in that direction, obviously that would be the best case.
Okay.
Even if that happens, we don't know how many iterations, how many waves, we have to go through before we get there.
All right, we do have to take a break, so we'll get John Barry's take on his earlier book, The Great Influenza, and its comparison to today. And there are some distinctions, there are some similarities, and we'll talk about it with this fabulous writer when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and John M. Barry is with us, the author of several books, all of which have been well received, but two of the most notable books of the last 30 years, Rising Tide and The Great Influenza. And of course, the latter one is the one that is analogous and relevant today as we discuss COVID-19. And John Barry is writing a new book that he says will be out and about in a few years about the experiences we're facing now. And I'm sure he will have information that nobody else does. And he did talk last week, spent the day with one Anthony Fauci. If you'd like to talk with John, 877-217-5757. And when you were on our show a year ago, you noted that there are some similarities. In 1918, there was this huge pandemic which killed a bigger percentage of Americans than the current one. And people thought at one time it was over, and then they found out the hard way it wasn't. Are we experiencing some of the same byproducts of a pandemic now that we faced as a country a century ago?
Yeah, obviously we have. Certainly in late June and early July, we thought we were in great shape, and obviously that was a mistake. I think one of the biggest differences between the two pandemics, there are a lot of similarities, a lot of differences, but one of the biggest differences is timing. Influenza moves much faster than COVID-19 in every way. The virus mutates faster, incubation's faster, serial transmission, how long it takes before somebody infects someone else is faster. And both seasonal influenza and the 1918 virus move through a community in a relatively short period of time, sometimes as short as 4 weeks, rarely more than 8 or 10 weeks, and then it's gone. And in 1918, there were very distinct troughs in between waves. People didn't know another wave was coming. They did relax quite a bit. You know, we've been dealing with this for 20 months right now. And the pressure on the economy and on society in general, people's mental health, everything else has been almost constant for that time. So we haven't had any relief. It's tough. And, you know, certainly economic damage this time around is much worse than 1918.
But on a percentage basis, more people died in 1918 as far as the per capita.
Many more. Yeah. And probably, you know, three times, maybe more than that. Worldwide, definitely much more than that. Worldwide, in 1918, there was probably 50 to 100 million people. And if you adjust for population, that would be the equivalent of 225 to 450 million people today. And even if you throw in modern medical care and antibiotic, a lot of people in 1918 actually died from secondary bacterial pneumonia. But even if you assume there'd be no shortage of antibiotics, mm-hmm. and healthcare system would not be overwhelmed, then everybody who needed an intensive care unit bed would get one. You would still end up with a minimum probably of 75 million dead.
John Barry, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. And listener, this is Gloria. Where's Gloria? She is in Tara, asking about heat, and supposedly that heat would be a carrier for the disease, actually a panacea for the disease. We found out that some of the hottest places on the planet, like Brazil, have some of the highest rates of transmission. What do you think about remember President Trump early on saying when the weather gets hot, we'll be okay. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, it's true that heat and humidity, that the virus survives less well outside the body when it's hot and humid than it does when it's cold with low humidity. That's true. Mm-hmm. But that is not, you know, the determinative fact regarding the virus. In fact, a year ago in April, I wrote an op-ed saying that don't expect a lot of relief from the summer. This would be the summer, not 2020. Because so many people were still susceptible to the virus. At that time when I wrote it, probably 95% of the population had not been exposed to it. I said susceptibility was going to be more important than seasonality. You know, that proved to be the case. And, you know, again, heat and humidity are a factor, but they're not the controlling factor. You know, how people are exposed to the virus, you know, close proximity and so mm-hmm. forth, that is a controlling factor.
Steve Winham in St. Francisville asks of John Barry, how do you compare President Trump's COVID actions with those of President Wilson during the great influenza?
Well, they were actually similar, but for very different reasons. Of course, in 1918, we were at war. And Wilson felt that any bad news would hurt morale and therefore hurt the war effort. So he actually never made a single public statement, not one, about the pandemic. And national public health leaders, there was no Tony Fauci in 1918, national public health leaders said things like, this is ordinary influenza by another name. It was referred to as Spanish influenza, even though it didn't start there, but got that name. Or you have nothing to worry about if proper precautions are taken. You know, these were nonsensical statements. In 1918, nobody believed those statements. The reason nobody believed them was, you know, you've heard the saying, McLuhan, the medium is the message. Well, the medium was daily life. And people could drop dead in less than 24 hours after the first symptom. Some of the symptoms were horrific, like bleeding from the ears as well as the nose and mouth. And young people were dying. Pregnant women, mm-hmm. 13 studies of hospitalized pregnant women, between 21% and 71% case mortality. Kids were particularly vulnerable under the age of 10. And then the second most vulnerable group was young adults. So you had this disease where people, you know, young, otherwise healthy people are dropping dead, sometimes very rapidly. So nobody paid any attention to what they were being told. This time around, Trump certainly tried to minimize the disease. Unfortunately, it got politicized. Instead of having a unified nation trying to confront this, as happened in many other countries, we had the politicization and the division, and we're still having it.
It's apparent that our country is divided by party affiliation, by ideology, on vaccines. You made the statement earlier that by Christmas, all but 10% of the country may have either been vaccinated or infected. That 10%, those who have not been vaccinated and have not been infected, what happens to them, John?
Well, eventually the virus is going to find them. You know, Delta is, you know, it's just too infectious. you know, the herd immunity doesn't really exist with this virus. what herd immunity sort of is like. It means that, you know, imagine a thief who goes into a neighborhood and tries one door after another, and every door he tries is locked. So he gives up, and walks away. Well, there are some houses in that neighborhood where the door is unlocked, but he doesn't find them. That's what herd immunity is like when it works perfectly.
All right. Well, you do have to take time for a break. And John is, of course, a man of much information that we are getting from him, and pleased that he is with us for another couple of segments. So there is still time to talk with him or send emails. Call us at 877-217-5757 or email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Back with the incomparable John Berry, author of Rising Tide and the Great Influenza, after this pause for the news on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. John Berry, the writer who lives most of the year at the French Quarter, in the French Quarter, spent much of his adult life in New Orleans, born in Providence, got his degree from the hometown university there, Brown University, the Ivy League institution that also educated Governor Jindal, a man that John Berry had some issues with. And John is now surveying the world that is fighting a pandemic, and some countries are doing it better than others. And he is looking at the situation like he always does, as an intrepid and investigative journalist, and analytically talking to a number of people who are on the front lines of this pandemic. Now, based on all the scenarios you gave a few moments ago, John, it appears that most of them are not all that bad. There are a few that are terrible, but on the whole, right now, as we talk on October 12th, 2021, we're in better shape than we were on October 12th a year ago.
I would agree with that. So, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, I'm still wary. I could be mistaken. I hope I'm not.
Well, I hope you're not either, and I'm sure our listeners do too. And another, Holly in the Garden District, asked why some countries have been affected differently than others. Is it policy? What is it? As you know, there are huge disparities on the numbers, or is it a case in which some countries might be fudging the numbers? Where are we right now?
Well, 90% of it is policy. There are some countries where I simply don't believe the numbers. North Korea would be probably the best example, where you certainly can't believe anything that they put out. Probably Iran, probably Russia, or understating. But 90% of the difference is policy in countries where there, you know, we know they're telling the truth. There are still great discrepancies. For example, between Sweden and Denmark, which pursued diametrically opposed policies. Sweden, well known for trying their herd immunity route and having many, many times the death toll of Denmark, and their economy is almost exactly the same as Denmark's. They didn't gain anything economically by pursuing a policy that ended up killing a lot more people.
Well, as I look at the list, the most current one I could find, the U.S., 715,000 deaths, Brazil, 601,000, India, 451,000. Russia.
Well, India is another one that is clearly way understated. There's probably, you know, at least several million dead in India.
Russia's at 214,000, but one of the countries that is suspiciously missing from the top of the list is China, where it began. Can we trust the numbers coming from China, or did they get it under control?
They did get it under control. They did things that, you know, we couldn't do in the United States, that nobody, including myself, would accept. But there are other countries, you know, most of them in Asia, not all of them. You know, South Korea, which is a democracy, Australia, which is very much like the United States, where the numbers are a tiny, tiny fraction of what the U.S. death toll is. I mean, in Australia, if you adjust for population, their death toll would be the equivalent of 15,000 in the United States. And we've got over 700,000. So policy makes a difference.
What could have been done to avert the 715,000, at least some of the 715,000 deaths in the U.S.?
Well, the first thing you would have had to tell the truth from the beginning and unify the country, which would not have been impossible. The only time in Trump's presidency that he cracked 50% in the approval numbers was about 48 hours after, in mid-March of 2020, he declared war on the virus. Mm-hmm. And if he had pursued that idea, there's a good chance, I think a very good chance, actually, he would have been reelected. And we would have done much, much, much better against the virus. But he didn't tell the truth. He kept, you know, undercutting his own scientific advisors. I mean, these are his people whom he appointed. You know, there's this idea that Tony Fauci and people at CDC are, you know, some kind of plot against Trump or even against the American society. I mean, it's crazy. These are people, the National Institutes of Health and CDC, who spend their lives trying to save people's lives. You know, I've got a good friend, I call a very senior scientist at National Cancer Institute, for example. He has turned down job offers at literally triple what he makes at NIH because he likes the purity of the research there, because he thinks that's where he can make the most progress saving people's lives. So the idea that someone at NIH is misleading the public for political reasons, it's just nuts. You know, I mean, you trust your own doctor. Why do you think the people at NIH are any different? They're not bureaucrats or scientists. They're trying to save people. But again, you know, the White House, for political reasons, undermined their own advisors. And the result is what we got.
President Trump, a few listeners in past weeks and a couple today sending messages online, should perhaps be taking some credit for getting the vaccine. He pushed hard for it. Did he have an effect on the acceleration of us getting it?
Well, he gets some credit for agreeing to pursue it. The funny thing is, the idea for that didn't come out of the White House. The idea came from what he called the deep state. And he could have said no, but he didn't. So he deserves, I mean, it did cost the government a lot of money to go that route, which it put at risk. So, yeah, I give him some credit for that. But it's not like it was his idea and he drove for it. The idea came from inside FDA and inside HHS and also some people outside were pushing for it and cooperating with it. So, yeah, you got some credit.
Have you had close friends, relatives die from it?
Yes, sure. I think a lot of people do. Plus, you know, I certainly look like I'm 40, right? But I'm over 70. So,
well, no, you were.
Yeah.
You were being as safe as you could be. You aren't going to embrace what they did in China. And by the way, I was just looking China, where this began. Now you could, of course, you can deliberate all you want about how it began, but they're only reporting 4,000 total deaths in the world's largest country. But you were going to a gym, right? And
I was.
As was I.
But I was opening the window where I worked out. Happened to be right next to the, you know, I a former, you know, competitive Olympic style lifter. I still do squats, and the squat rack was right next to the window. And I asked, had been nailed shut basically over the years because of air conditioning. I asked them to open the window and they did. And I still wore a mask, even in the midst of some pretty heavy breathing during those exercises.
It does appear that those who, for the most part, and there are exceptions, but for those who were affected most dramatically and died from COVID-19, obesity was almost a universal part of the mix.
Yeah, that's, true with a lot of infectious diseases. It's true with influenza. It puts a burden on the body to carry the extra weight, any comorbidity. That was certainly true in the 2009 minor pandemic. Didn't kill a lot of people, but those who did die tended to be obese.
Doug on Highland. Doug, you're on Talk Louisiana with John Barry. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen, and hope you're both doing well. Just wanted to find the issue of how to try to overcome the resistance factor, which, it can lead you to think that we'll never be able to really beat this virus or any other one, because wherever it comes from, the same thing will happen again if we have these same factors of the segments of society who are prey to misinformation and don't believe in science. So legally, I guess there are mandates. How do we deal with this? Or do we just let them destroy all of us because they think that's what they want to do?
John? Thank you, Doug.
Well, kind of an unanswerable question, unfortunately. People are thinking about this, including me. There's also a good chance there's going to be a COVID commission, which would be run by the same person who ran the 9/11 commission. As you recall, that commission report was praised universally by every political stripe. And that commission, if it does come into existence, will not only look at what did happen, but try to come up with some solutions.
877-217-5757. We will finish the hour with John Barry, author of The Great Influenza and Rising Tide. And we'll even cover a few other matters with this fine gentleman when we return after this message. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana today. And if you'd like to get in before we part company with John Barry, 877-217-5757, the author of The Great Influenza. And I'm sure in a few years we'll be talking about the book that John provides regarding the pandemic, which is now in its third year, starting at the end of 2019 and now extending almost through the end of 2021 and likely into next year, and who knows from there. But we hopefully are at the end of the worst part of it, and it appears we are, but we can't let our guard down. And that brings us to another remark from a listener who mentioned, and I think I recall this, Jason Barry, also lives in New Orleans, spells his last name different than John, great writer in his own right. He said, I think it was Jason, and the listener ought to know since they're citing him, said he talked with you many years ago and you said it wasn't if but when we would have a pandemic. You saw this coming. I'm sure there's no great delight in saying I told you so, is there?
Well, I wasn't that original. Anybody who understood anything about infectious disease and viruses, knew that there would be another pandemic, and a pandemic after this one, and pandemic after that one, and pandemic after that one. There are a lot of viruses out there and other pathogens that can adapt and have the ability to infect humans that we haven't been exposed to. And whenever a new pathogen enters the human population, if it's highly transmissible, like COVID-19 or influenza, then you'll get another pandemic. The question is, how do we respond to it? How quickly we identify it? obviously, the science has advanced dramatically. We've got the vaccine in a matter of months. That's extraordinary. But you're still in the even if we got a vaccine, you know, faster, you're still talking about manufacturing billions of doses to protect the world and distributing that, you know, so technology is not going to be the answer in the future. It's a big part of the answer, but you're still going to have a gap of months when you're going to have to deal with it without the benefit of vaccines.
Is there the strong possibility that in our lifetime, which is shorter than some of our other listeners, that we could experience this again?
Sure. You know, go back to Katrina and Rita, you know. Just because you have a pandemic one year doesn't mean you can have a different virus hitting you almost immediately, just like hurricanes. You know, you could go decades without one hitting you, and then you can get two or three in successive years. It's totally random.
Bill downtown. Bill, you're on the air with John Barry. Hi, Bill.
You know, one of the responses to the 27 flood was to build levees all up and down the Mississippi River. After Katrina, we built a bunch of levees, and now they're saying some of those are hurting some of the communities south of New Orleans. What are the kind of things we should look out for our responses to this as we move into the future?
All right.
I think that's a good question. I don't really have an answer to it. One of the lessons that we learned from this one is, for 15 years, I was saying the number one lesson from 1918 was to tell the truth. That saves lives. I think that lesson has been confirmed by this. The countries that told the truth acted decisively, whether they were a democracy or an authoritarian country, whether they were Australia or whether they were China, have done really pretty well. In those countries that fudged or outright lied, whether it was Iran. And don't you hate to put Iran in the same category as the United States? I do. Obviously Brazil, which has minimized it even more than the last administration did. They did not do very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a benefit in the sense that even a pure politician who cares about nothing but his or her self-interest in the future is going to look back at this and realize that it was key to Trump's defeat, whereas political leaders like Merkel and Germany, who had not been that popular, rose to new heights of popularity because of her handling of this pandemic. So the lesson, even for a politician purely interested in self-interest, is to do it right.
Would Trump have been reelected, in your estimation, had it not been for COVID?
If he had done a good job, I think there's a good chance of it, yeah. Certainly it was key to his defeat. You know, whether he had done better, I mean, it would have been an entirely different campaign. There's plenty of anti-Trump sentiment out there regardless, but it would have been a much different campaign. So it's hard to say.
And he is a man who has passionate followers, but for those who say that it cost him the election, he never got above 46% in a national election, and that usually does not cut it. He didn't win in the overall vote either time, but that, of course, is a topic for another day. Here's one from Bill Huey saying, your thoughts about the Louisiana Coastal Protection Restoration Authority's plan to thwart coastal erosion. Is it a good plan?
Well, the master plan was, Jim, and probably a lot of your listeners know, I served on the CPRA for 6 years until the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East filed a lawsuit against many oil companies for their role in coastal land loss. You know, the master plan, I think, is a good plan. The real problem with it is funding. I think the most generous possible accounting would give the state another maybe $12 billion. And the plan actually costs at least $100 billion. You know, its price tag is nominally $50 billion, but that's not a real cost. The real cost is going to be more than double that.
Gaston on Highland. Gaston, please be brief. Our time is short with John Berry. You have the floor, my friend.
Thank you, Jim. I just wanted to make a comment that because of the former president's response, he lost a lot of voters between January and November because he didn't encourage people to mask up.
Oh, people who died. Yeah, well, that's true. I'm sure that some of the people who would have voted for Donald Trump weren't around to cast ballots. I hadn't thought about that, but you got a point. John and I go back a long way, and I love the fact that he was on the field December 1, 1973 at Tulane Stadium when the Greenies beat LSU 14-0 to end a 25-year streak of no losses for the Tigers. But Coach O apparently is all but gone. He may very well lose his job if LSU loses to Florida. I was looking, John, LSU's endowment $600 million. Tulane's is about $2 billion, and Tulane, of course, pales in comparison to the Ivy League schools, but does LSU still have the money, based on your knowledge of college football, to open the vault and go after another big-name coach and pay the other guy $22 million not to coach? Your thoughts?
Well, athletic departments tend to, you know, get their own money from other sources. I think LSU's probably got enough alumni that would rally for a winning football coach. You know, I like Orgeron.
You do?
Well, I like him. You know, I don't know him personally, but obviously you got to love the guy. You wish that he was more successful. You know, I agree with your estimation that, you know, if he's got to start winning, and it doesn't look like he's going to be able to put it together, but, you know, stranger things have happened. And I wish him well. So, you know, but would I approve of, you know, paying huge buyouts of coaches? I think the coaching salaries are absolutely obscene. I know when I coached, Benny Ellender was named National Coach of the Year, and they gave him a brand new 10-year contract, and I think it was like $40,000. Now, you add inflation in there, and it would be up to several hundred thousand dollars, but not the millions of dollars that people were taking. I remember having lunch with the head football coach of a Division I school in the spring, and we were talking about the salaries, and he agreed that they were absolutely obscene, but he wasn't going to give his salary back. I don't blame him.
No, you take what the market bears, and Coach O will be a rich man, and that's why the kinds of pressures coaches face today are much different than what Benny Ellender faced. He I don't know what his buyout was, but it wasn't $22 million. And right. John, we are short on time, but it is always a delight to catch up with you. I hope we keep it going, and I'm sure your book will be another book for the ages. Thank you, my friend.
Well, kind of you to say.
See you soon. Be safe. And for those who've stayed with us the full hour, I'm sure we learned a lot from John Berry today. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting. Until tomorrow, stay safe and stay tuned.